Good afternoon. My name is Chris Weissopel. I'm the CTO and co-founder of Veracode. Veracode's an application security company. We test all kinds of different applications, and what I'm going to talk about today is mobile application security. My background is I've been doing security research for a very long time, probably about as long as anybody. I started in the mid-90s. And it was a time that was pretty interesting because we had a paradigm change in the mid-90s. We had, all of a sudden, everyone's computer was hooked up to the internet, and then we had the beginnings of web applications, and that's what I focused on a lot then. It's interesting now we have another paradigm change happening with computing, which is the shift to mobile applications. So I feel it's kind of a similar time than it was in the late 90s when we were investigating web applications and finding defects like session management errors and SQL injection, which really didn't exist before. And all of a sudden, they were everywhere in web applications. And now, a lot of time I spend is looking at mobile applications and looking at what's going on out there in the wild. So, mobile applications are really going to be the dominant computing platform. So we really need to spend a lot of time, if you're in the security industry, focusing on web applications. You know, there are 29 billion mobile apps downloaded in 2011. There's predicted to be 76 billion apps by 2014. There's 686 million devices going to be purchased this year. So this is where people are going to be doing the majority of their client computing going forward. I was talking to a vice president at Fidelity Investments a couple months ago, and he said they just saw more traffic doing financial transactions from their customer base on their mobile application than on their website. So we have a common use for the web in the past has been checking your stock quotes, managing your portfolio, and we're actually seeing that in 2012 switch over to be more dominant on the mobile platform. So certainly if there's going to be any criminal activity, any malicious activity, it's going to start to going to be focused on the mobile platform over time as people switch over to that. So if you look at the mobile platform, to look at the risks of the platform, it's useful to break it down into the different layers, just like you would do it on a desktop computer, and you think about the different layers, software, operating system, network layer, hardware layer, and of course there's vulnerabilities on all those layers. The same thing happens on mobile. But mobile, it seems that some of those layers are worse off. For one, it's the network layer is more problematic on mobile because a lot of people have, in their office or at home, they have wired connections or they have secure Wi-Fi connections. And with a lot of mobile devices, you're obviously outside of the home or outside of the office a lot. And if you're using Wi-Fi there, you might be using an insecure Wi-Fi connection, something that's a public Wi-Fi connection. So when we think about mobile apps, we have to take into account that the network environment is riskier for those applications. When Wi-Fi is being used. And when I get into more of the web, the mobile application risks, you'll see why that's more important. There are risks at the hardware level on mobile devices. This is an area of ongoing research. People call these broadband attacks or baseband attacks, where you're attacking the firmware that's listening on the radio. These are really scary attacks because the user doesn't have to do anything. You can hit lots of devices within RF range at once. And it seems like whenever this research bubbles up, it quickly kind of gets sort of classified where people swoop in around and say, here, tell us about that and please stop talking about it. So there's some research going on in the broadband area. But it seems to be very hush-hush. I think it's more of a nation-state type of research that's going on. An area of active research, though, is the operating system layer. And again, this is different than in the desktop computing world. because in the mobile space, you have these teams of people called jailbreakers. And jailbreakers are different than regular vulnerability researchers. They're trying to find vulnerabilities in the operating system, but the reason they're trying to find the vulnerabilities is not to break into someone else's machine and compromise it. It's to break into their own computer, right? They want to break into their own mobile, modify their own mobile's operating system so that they can run the applications of their choice and change things with full administrative permissions. And they don't want to tell the vendor about this. They're not like a security researcher, which is a white hat security researcher, which is going to do responsible disclosure and tell the vendor about it. They want to do this research, and they want to actually publish it in an exploit or a rootkit or a jailbreak code, and they want to do it strategically, like right after, you know, the vendor ships the new operating system. So you have this sort of adversarial relationship with OS level vulnerabilities on the mobile, which I think is quite interesting. One place we see it is it makes it so that there's good published exploit code out there for kernel level vulnerabilities. And we've seen those actually be used by malware writers. So it's a little bit different than the PC world. And then the final layer is the top layer, the application layer. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. The other layers exist and the other layers play into it, but I'm mostly going to talk about what's going on at the application layer where code is running in the sandbox. It doesn't have administrative privileges. It has to use the APIs of the device, but still a lot of malicious activity and a lot of risk can happen at that layer because that's the layer where all the information is. Apps can access all the information on the device if they have the right permissions. And they can access the different sensors on the device, GPS sensor, microphone, camera, what have you. So even though we're only talking about at the application layer, we have a lot of risk there. The other thing that's different about the mobile environment is all the operating system players, be it BlackBerry or Android or iOS or Windows Mobile, they all have a fine-grained permission model. And this is one of the ways that they built into the operating system the idea that it's not as risky as you think. Even though you have all your contacts on there, all your personal information, you got your photos, you have your location on there, you're storing your bank PIN for auto login on there. It's safe because apps have to have certain permissions to get at certain parts of the information on the device. And the user has to be presented with these permissions and say okay. The problem with it is the user always says okay. As a security person, I know you can prompt the user, say something really bad is going to happen. Do you want it to happen? And if they're in a rush or there's something really enticing on the other side of that, like a game is going to be installed that they've been waiting for, they're going to click OK. So that's why I say on my slide here, just let me fling birds at pigs already. And you can see on the slide here, there's examples of a BlackBerry permission box. It says, please set the BlackBerry travel application permissions after clicking button below. And basically, the user is just going to say, set the permissions and save. Here's an Android prompt where it shows things, and it actually puts something that almost looks like a warning. It's got a sort of a yield sign there saying, network communication, phone call, but the user is going to click install, right? And then the Apple one is completely innocuous, right? It doesn't give any kind of warning. It's just like, Apple would like to use your current location, right? So of course you're gonna click OK. So there is this fine-grained permission model, and apps have to have a manifest file where they declare the permissions they need, and that will get displayed to the user, and the user will have to say, I grant these permissions. But let's be honest, users are just gonna always say OK. So let's take a quick look at the permissions that these apps are asking for and some of the permissions that are there. This company, Praetorian, did a survey last year of 53,000 applications analyzed in the Android market and third-party market. So this was all Android. And the average app requested 3 permissions. Some apps requested 117 permissions. So obviously these are very fine-grained and way too complex for a user to understand if they're presented with, this app needs these 117 permissions, right? It's like the end-user license agreement that's, you know, 45 pages long. Maybe soon they'll have an option where it's like, print the permissions and send me an email. But if you look at some of the top interesting permissions, 24% of the apps that they downloaded out of the 53,000 requested GPS information from the device. 8% read the contacts. 4% sent SMS, and 3% received SMS. 2% recorded audio. 1% process outgoing calls. So I don't know. I don't think 4% of the apps in the App Store really need to send SMS text messages. So I think that's a hint that, you know, something untoward is going on. 8% of the apps need to read your contacts list. It's probably not necessary. One of the other interesting things about permissions is if you link in shared libraries into your application, those inherit the permissions of the application. So if your app needs the contact list or needs the GPS location to function, and you link in an advertising library, for instance, that ad library will also be able to access the contacts and also be able to access the GPS location, right? And the developer of the app knows nothing about the code that's running in the ad library. They're just linking that in because they want to monetize their app. So this is where, and I'll talk about some examples of this with an application called Pandora, where an application developer might unwittingly be leaking information from their users because of libraries they've linked in. So surveying the landscape out there, looking at all the different apps that have been reported in the news as malicious or doing something users didn't want, and then inspecting a lot of apps. We do a lot of static binary analysis on mobile apps, so we've inspected them and looked at the code itself. We came up with what we call our top 10 list of risky behaviors in applications. And it's broken down into two sections, malicious code. So these are bad things that the apps might be doing that are likely to be something that a malicious individual has specifically put in the application, but it's a little bit fuzzy. It could be something that a developer thinks is fine, but it ends up being thought of as malicious by the user. And then the second section is what we call coding vulnerabilities, and these are things where the developer basically is making mistakes or just doesn't understand how to write the app securely, and that's putting the app user at risk. So I'm going to go through these in detail and give some examples. For reference, I wanted to put up the OWASP mobile top 10 list. So this is the 10 issues that a group at OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project, they have a working group working on a mobile top 10 list. They have a very famous web top 10 list, which is the top 10 riskiest things you can have in a web application. They're doing the same thing for mobile. And their list is a little different than ours. 6 out of the 10 are the same. They have 4 that are different. I think they have a little bit of a different take on risk in mobile apps, where a lot of their issues are really how the application is communicating to a back-end server or what's going on the back-end server, not so much apps that have risky behavior that are just straightforward client apps. So the ones in red here are the differences between the two lists. And some of my research team has actually contributed to this project, so we'll see what happens over time. But I think the takeaway here is we don't really know what the top 10 list is in mobile apps because they've really only been around for 2 or 3 years now. And there just hasn't been enough time to really research the operating systems and what they're capable of. And there hasn't been enough time for the malicious community, if you will, to have spent enough time trying to attack users through mobile apps. So I expect these lists to change a little bit. But for now, these are the top 10 things to worry about. So you might wonder on the mobile side, where does the malicious mobile code, how does it get onto the device? So North Carolina State has a project called the Mobile Malware Genome Project, where they are just collecting as much mobile malware as they can and analyzing it. And they've broken down the injection vectors that the mobile malware uses. And 86% uses a technique called repackaging. So, and this is only on the Android platform. Can you really do this repackaging? The reason is Android code is built with a Java bytecode called Dalvik, which is easily decompilable. So the bad guy can do is take an Android application, decompile it, insert their malicious code, recompile it, and then put it up in the App Store as purporting to be a new version of that application, or just maybe changing the name of the application. So if it was some sort of game, just sort of change the name slightly. And so this repackaging is how 86% of mobile malware gets distributed. There's another technique called update, which is very similar to repackaging, but you actually don't put the malicious code in. What you do is you put in a small update mechanism. You decompile, you put in an update mechanism, and you recompile it. And then when the app is running, it pulls down the malware onto the device. So, you know, by far, the majority is those two techniques. There isn't really much drive-by downloads on mobiles, which, you know, it could be like, hey, check, you know, like a phishing attack, hey, check out this really cool website, or you need to go to this website and fill out this form to continue doing something. Those are phishing attacks. The same thing can happen on the mobile platform where they point to a mobile app to download. Say, you know, hi, this is Bank of America. We see you're using this application. You should download this other application. Theoretically, that could work. Maybe it just isn't being used enough, but to determine whether it's successful or not. But they found that less than 1% of the time that technique is used. So the majority of the time, it's really a repackaged code. There's another category called standalone, where someone just builds a brand new application. They build an application that purports to be something. It's not a repackaging of something else, and that has the malicious code. That's used 14% of the time. So now I want to talk about what is the malicious code doing. So one of the first malware out there was, you know, you could consider a spyware. It basically spies on the user. It collects emails, SMS messages. It turns on the microphone. It harvests the contact book, and it sends it off to someone else. This type of spyware exists on the PC. So it makes perfect sense for people to try to do this on mobile devices. One of the first examples of this was a program called Secret SMS Replicator. It was in the Android marketplace a couple of years ago. And the idea was, if you had access to someone's Android phone that you wanted to spy on, so maybe it's your spouse or your significant other, and you want to spy on their text messaging, you could download this app and install it and configure it to send an SMS text message to you with a copy of every SMS text message they got. So this obviously is in violations of the App Store terms of service, and this was removed from the Android marketplace within 18 hours of it being there. So a very small number of people were at risk because of this. Now, I think that if the program was called something maybe a little less provocative, like Secret SMS Replicator, it probably would have worked a lot better. But it was kind of obvious. So one of the things we can do to determine if apps have this behavior that we don't want is to inspect the code. So this is actually really easy to do on Android because we can decompile the apps. On iOS, you can use a disassembler like IDA Pro to look at what APIs the app is calling and what it's doing. We wrote our own binary static analyzer at Veracode, and we do this. And so what you could do is you could say, does the device do anything that is basically spying on me or tracking me? And I have some examples here on the iPhone. This first example is how to access the UUID on the phone. This is actually something that Apple has just banned for new applications, but old applications that you might have running on your phone can still do this. And so that unique identifier can be used to track you across many different applications. On the Android, I have an example here of getting the device's location. So you can see that if that API call is there, that app is tracking, and you can see whether it's getting find location or course location. And then on the bottom here, I have an example of how on the BlackBerry an application might access the email messages in your inbox. So these are the kind of things you can inspect to see if the app is doing those things. Second big category of malicious behavior, and this is probably the biggest category now, is unauthorized dialing, unauthorized premium SMS text messages, or unauthorized payments. So another thing that's unique about the phone is the device is hooked to a billing account. And when activities happen on the phone, it can create charges. You can purchase things over the phone. When you send a premium SMS text message, you're actually giving money to the account holder of the phone number on the other side. These were set up to get stock quotes or get your daily horoscope or other things. But they can be set up to, order a product by sending an SMS text. People give money to the Red Cross by sending a text message to give $10 that way. So the attackers, what they've done is they set up accounts in foreign countries, and they embed in the malware that the phone will send a premium SMS text message, say, a few times a day. And at the end of the month, you realize you spent tens or maybe even hundreds of dollars, and they walk away with the money. This got so bad that this was the very first thing that the Android marketplace or the Google Play, it was the Android marketplace at the time, it's now Google Play, the first thing that Google started checking for. When Google started distributing Android apps in their app store, they said, hey, we're not going to check for anything. We'll pull apps once we've been notified they've broken our terms of service, but we're not going to check for anything. Well, about a year ago, it got so bad with these premium SMS text message malware that they actually started, this was the very first thing they started checking for. So if an app can send SMS text messages, they further manually scrutinize that application. So they look for the APIs that call this. And now, since then, Google has expanded, but this was the first thing that they started looking for. Some other apps that did some SMS text messages, this Android QuickSomos, I guess it is called. There was this current event on the mobile where this Carrier IQ came out as spyware put on the device by the carriers. So people wanted to know if their phone was vulnerable to this, and this was a free app that tested that. Well, of course, what this app did was it sent premium SMS text messages. So by testing to see if you're infected with spyware, you loaded malware onto your device. We saw the same thing happen at the last Super Bowl. There was a bogus version of Madden football game that sent premium SMS text messages. It actually tried to create a bot network too on the device. So here I have some examples. Interestingly enough, Apple was pretty smart, and they don't allow applications to send SMS text messages at all. And no app can do it. That's a great way of getting rid of a whole class of vulnerability. But on Android, you can do it, and of course, on BlackBerry, you can do it too. It's interesting that on the BlackBerry, all you need is internet permissions to send an SMS text message. The other thing that really we look for when we're looking to see if something is malicious is just any kind of unauthorized network activity. Like, look at the network activity the app is supposed to have its functionality, and look at this other network activity. So, you know, perhaps an app to work has to get data over HTTP, but if it's doing things over email or SMS or Bluetooth or something like that, now that app could potentially be malicious. So this is another thing you can inspect for. And on the slide here, I have some examples of that. Another interesting thing we saw with malware happened, this was back in 2009, and it happened in a big way. I don't know if it's happened so much since then, was an app that impersonated another application. So there was the set of apps, and it was dubbed the 09 Droid attack. And someone decided that there were a lot of small, regional, mid-sized banks that didn't have online banking applications. So what they did was they built about 50 online banking applications that all they did was take the username and password and redirect you to the website. And so they put these all up in the Google Marketplace, in the Android Marketplace, and when someone searched to see if their bank had an application, they would find the bogus application, which collected their credentials and then just redirected them to their website. So the way that this actually became, the apps were up there for a few weeks, and there were thousands and thousands of downloads. The way this came to light was, someone was having a problem with one of the applications, and they called their bank. And they called their bank's customer support line and said, "I'm having a problem with your mobile banking application. Can you help me out?" And they said, "We don't have a mobile banking application." So that started the investigation. That bank called Google. Then Google looked and said, "Wow, the same author has written 50 bank applications," and took them all down. But certainly this could happen again. There's the list of all the different banks here that were part of the scam. The other thing an app can do is present the UI of another application. So while it's running, it could pop up the Facebook UI. It says you have to put in your username and password to continue, or put up any username and password UI for a website that maybe the user uses, just to try to trick the user into putting the credentials in. This is really a straight parallel of the email phishing attacks, where someone sends you an email message and gives you basically a fake UI for a website that you have access to. The other thing we look for in malicious code is system modification. So you can look for all the API calls that require root privilege to execute correctly. So like changing the device's web proxy would be something that an application shouldn't be able to do, right? But if the application has code in there to do that, you know that it's probably a malicious application, or very highly likely to be a malicious application. And so what would happen is that app would have some way of escalating privilege. It would have some privilege escalation exploit in the application, and then once it escalated privileges, it would do these system modifications. So you can find malware that has privilege escalation in it, even without knowing how the privilege escalation exploit is gonna happen. And that's a nice, easy way to look for malware. Droid Dream was probably the most famous piece of Android malware. I think it affected about 250,000 users over a few days before it was found. They made 50, they repackaged 50 bogus applications, put them in the Android App Store, And essentially, it did have it used Android jailbreak code to escalate privileges and then install command and control and turn all the victims into a botnet. But you could have detected this if you were scanning the application and just looking for API calls that required root permission to execute correctly. And so there's an example here I have is changing the proxy. And this actually is only available on the Android. So you can see I'm giving a lot of examples on Android because this is where the most active malware ecosystem is, because it's really easy for an attacker to get malicious code into the Android marketplace. It's not so easy to do that in the Apple App Store because Apple requires developers to identify themselves and sign the code. They actually check, you know, who you are, and Apple's actually scrutinizing the applications. So we just don't see a lot of true malware where the device is getting compromised. I will talk about some examples where it's really privacy is getting compromised, and that's what's really happening on the Apple device. Another thing to look for malicious code, risky code in devices is logic or time bombs. And time bombs are probably much easier to look for than logic bombs. But with time bombs, what you can do is you can look for places in the code where the time is tested or an absolute time is looked for before certain functionality in the app happens. And this could be done to hide that activity from the user, so it's happening late at night. Droid Dream did all its activity between 11 p.m. and 8 a.m. Local time to try to do it while the user might not be using their device. Another reason to do this is if people are using behavioral analysis of an application, running the app in a sandbox to see what the behavior of the application is, they can use time-based logic to do the activity when the app isn't in the sandbox. So, for example, you know, an app store like Apple runs the application. But they probably don't run every application for, say, 30 days before approving it, right? So you could put logic in your application that said, okay, only do the bad thing after 30 days have gone by, or after 30 days after the published date of the application. And that can help the malicious code hide from people inspecting for it. So if antivirus companies are running things in sandboxes, or the app stores themselves are, this can help hide that from that inspection. Now, the flip side of that is it's easy to find with static analysis. So actually inspecting the code, you can look for all the places where the application tests the time and inspect that way. And here I just have some examples of on these three different platforms how time can be checked for by the app maker, so you can know what to look for if you're inspecting the app statically. So I just went through a whole bunch of different malicious activities that we've seen in the wild, but which ones are the most prevalent? So that same study from North Carolina State Mobile Genome Project published some data, and there was basically four areas that they saw there was a lot of activity. 37% of the apps did privilege escalation, so they had some type of jailbreak code in there where they tried to escalate privileges so that they could do API commands running as the operating system. 45% of the apps out there did premium SMS, so that's a huge percentage is trying to directly monetize. 93% did remote control, So they tried to set up a botnet, a mobile botnet, and 45% harvested identifying information like phone numbers, UUIDs, GPS location, user accounts. So, and this adds up to more than 100 because most malware tries to do a few of these things. So now I'm going to switch to the second half and talk about the code vulnerabilities. This is the second half of the risky activity. So this is where essentially the developer is making errors. A legitimate developer writing a legitimate app is making errors or is ignorant of the risks of the mobile platform. They just don't know how to make a secure mobile app. Or sometimes the developer doesn't care about putting the user at risk. Sometimes part of their business model might be harvesting the user's personal information. So that's sort of the other category. And that's why some of this malicious versus legitimate starts to bleed over, because there's difference of opinions between what the user wants and what the user considers risky and what the application developer considers risky. Of course, it's not the application developer's data in most cases. And then finally, another way this happens is a developer might link in a shared library that has vulnerabilities or this risky behavior in it, unbeknownst to them. So the first category is sensitive data leakage. And this is when the app collects information like location, address book information, owner information, and sends that off the device. And once it's off the device, we don't know what's happening with that information. It could be stored insecurely by the application developer. We've seen application developers get compromised, and the data that they're storing gets taken. This happened a few months ago to a developer down in Florida, where a huge number of it was iPad UUIDs and device names were leaked because someone I think it was anonymous claimed to do this, broke into this developer's servers and stole millions of iPad UUIDs and computer names. You know, not the most risky information, but what if that was storage of, you know, usernames and passwords and home addresses? You know, there's lots of apps that store that kind of information. So the risk is there. The other thing that can happen is if the developer doesn't take care to secure the data channel, and that's another big vulnerability I'm going to talk about, that data is being sent in the clear. So if the user's on a public Wi-Fi network, or someone sniffing the internet somewhere along the path, that data is being exposed. One very famous case of this information leakage happened with Pandora. And this is something we researched at Veracode. We heard that there was I think it was a Federal Trade Commission investigation going on with Pandora, and we said, what's going on there? Let's start digging into the Pandora application. And what we determined was the Pandora application collected your gender and your age, and it also accessed your GPS location. And the Pandora application did this for what they said were legitimate reasons, right? The music that they were playing, Pandora is a music streaming app, the music they were playing was only licensed in the United States. So they had to check to comply with their license agreements that they had for the music that the user was in the United States. They also wanted to comply with the parental advisory around adult language in music. And so it's a voluntary program, but they wanted to comply with that and not play explicit lyrics to children 13 and under. So they had legitimate reasons for collecting this data, right? So they had their app had the permissions to do it. Users thought this was legitimate. But what happened? They linked in three or four different ad libraries. Now all of a sudden, all these ad libraries are getting access to the same information, right? The ad libraries, if you look at the code in the ad libraries, what they do is every ad library says, does my app have permission to get GPS location? Oh, it does? Okay, tell me the GPS location. So every single ad library does that. If the app doesn't have GPS permission, it won't be able to get it. But if it does, it will get it. So this is where the business model of the ad libraries is opposed to the privacy of the user. And there's been studies out there that will say if you know the age of a person and you know their location where they sleep at night, right, because you have their GPS coordinates, right, while they perhaps are sleeping, you know exactly who that person is because you can determine which member of that household is that person. So really this is identifying to advertisers exactly who you are, and it looks like it was legitimate, right? You know, I just want my streaming music and this is the only way to get it. Well, we exposed this. We wrote this up in several blog posts, and it turned out that someone from Rolling Stone magazine read one of our blog posts and wrote their own blog in Rolling Stone about it. And the very next day, Pandora thought it was a good idea to remove the ad libraries from their application. As far as I know, they should be commended. I think they're the only sort of freemium type of app that has done this. All the other freemium apps have the same behavior. So you got to think about what kind of data you're giving these freemium applications, because it's all going to advertisers. The Praetorian also did a study about shared libraries and said, let's look at what shared libraries are the top shared libraries. And this was the data. They analyzed 53,000 apps. And the number one shared library was AdMob. It was actually in 38% of the applications out there. So 38% of the applications you're using are likely harvesting your personal information and sending it to the ad networks. The Apache, Android were 8 and 6%. And then these other ones down the bottom, Google Ads, Comflurry, MobiCity, these are all Millennial Media. These are all ad companies. And then, interestingly enough, 4% linked in the Facebook library, probably to do authentication through Facebook, so the app could authenticate the Facebook. But that also means the corporation Facebook controls code that's running in 4% of the Android mobile apps out there, right? And they have access to all the data that has permission to get at. Facebook essentially tries to sell advertising space, right? That's their business model. So if you look at this whole ecosystem with these permissions and shared libraries, you start to see that you have a lot of risk in a supposedly legitimate application. The same similar thing that happened with Pandora happened with an application called Path. And Path thought, you know, they were being, you know, helpful, friendly developers. They were just trying to give you a great user experience. And it turned out that without prompting the user or telling the user anything, and this happened on the iPhone and on Android, the Pandora app was on iPhone and Android, that the Path application was grabbing your entire address book and uploading it to Path just when you installed and ran the application, and they didn't tell you about this, right? They thought it was just really helpful for you to have, to be able to share with all the people in your address book that you're using the Path application. Well, obviously Path thought this was great for their company, not so great to the user, right? You know, you have to think that, you know, it's one thing if, you know, maybe a teenager is using this application, and you know their dozens of friends are in there, but what if it's the CEO of a company installs Path, and then all of a sudden their whole address book is up there? You're going to get a lot of potentially valuable contact information for a lot of people. A reporter from the New York Times, you might be able to get the phone number for ex-presidents from their address book. So. Obviously, a lot of sensitive information gets transferred with something like this. There was such a big flap about this that Path apologized, they changed their app, and even impacted Apple. Apple said, we're going to force app vendors to prompt users if they if they're going to collect their entire address book. Okay, so it looks like what's happening here is when there's one big privacy violation and it makes the press, we see a change out there. But of course there's other things out there. The LinkedIn application harvests your calendar entries, but there's no, Apple doesn't make the user be prompted about that, right? Calendar entries can have sensitive information in them too. So, you know, where are you going to draw the line? This is really kind of an evolving place where there's really no good standard out there for the users to understand when their information is going to be at risk and when they're going to know it's being taken. We wrote an app at Veracode called Adios, and essentially it allowed you to point the app at your iTunes directory and look at all the applications that were harvesting your full address book. And as you can see on this list here, you know, Angry Birds, AIM, Around Me. Why does Angry Birds need your address book? I don't know, but it does somehow. So this is just something that many applications do. You can inspect the code for this. There's well-defined APIs for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry to get at the address book. So you can really easily inspect for this, and this is what we did in our Adios application. The next category, unsafe sensitive data storage, is something where developers just take something like a PIN or an account number or a password and just store it in the clear on the device. Even worse, they might store it in an area on the phone which is globally accessible, like the SD card. You see this more often on Android because Android allows for an SD card. iPhone devices don't. But we even saw this happen in a Citigroup application. Their online banking application stored the account numbers insecurely, right? Just in the clear. So if you lost your device, essentially you lost your bank account. This is why I personally don't do banking on my iPhone. I just think it's too risky right now to do these kind of activities. Skype did the same thing. Skype, of course, has an account balance, a username and password to access that balance. They were storing all that information in the clear on the mobile device. So I have some examples here of creating files that don't have the right permissions, or writing to disk and not having any encryption happen for that. This next area, unsafe sensitive data transmission, I've alluded to this a few times, and because of public Wi-Fi, this is something that apps absolutely need to do. And this is probably what we see go wrong the most. I would say, actually, I think I have the actual data, but it's close to half the mobile applications screw up doing SSL. They just don't use the APIs correctly. I mean, it's all you got to do is follow the instructions and use the APIs. But they do things like not check whether there is an invalid certificate at the other end, not check if the other end is trying to do a protocol downgrade attack. So the developers, they just want to get they want to get their checkbox, right? Their requirement is to use SSL. They've used SSL. The requirement isn't to use SSL securely. And so this is why all applications that use SSL to secure data as it's being transmitted off the device really need to be inspected to make sure that it was implemented correctly. And here I have some examples where you can see an application might be using HTTP instead of HTTPS. Some cases, apps will fall back to HTTP if the HTTPS isn't working. I have another call here on Android where they've disabled the certificate check. So a man-in-the-middle attack can happen. An invalid certificate can be will be accepted. So these are all cases where attackers are going to be able to get on the same Wi-Fi connection as the user and access all the data that's being sent over the internet. And finally, last category I have here is hard-coded password and keys. We actually see a lot of developers use the same coding style that they did when they were building web server applications. So they're building a Java server application and they're hard-coding the key. Well, when you're building a server application, yeah, hard-coding the key is not a good idea, right? It makes it difficult to change. But it's not so bad on the server side because who has access to the server side? Only the administrators. But if you take the same code and you port it over to a mobile application, now everyone who has that mobile application has access to that hard-coded key. And we actually see this a lot of times. I have some statistics on how often we see this happen. It actually was in example code that MasterCard published on how to use their service. Their example code showed how you would just take the password and put it in a hard-coded string right there. And we know how developers love to copy and paste code snippets when they're trying to do something. And so you copy and paste the code snippet that they gave as example code, and you have an insecure application. And here we just have some examples. This first one is one we see a lot where they just hard code the data right into a URL that gets sent. Sometimes we see like string password equals the password. It's pretty easy to detect, or a string password on BlackBerry and Android. So it's actually pretty easy to check for, because almost always the developer names the variable that's holding the password, some variation of password. So I mentioned that we do static analysis at Veracode. So we've analyzed several hundred Android and iOS applications. So we've built full models of them, and we're able to scan them for different vulnerabilities, especially the vulnerabilities I was talking about. And it has some data here. 68.5% of the Android apps we looked at had broken cryptographic code, which for us, we can't detect if you made your own crypto routine. Like, not that that's a good idea. But this is actually using the published APIs that are on the platform, but doing them in such a way that the crypto would be vulnerable. 68.5. And this is for people that are sending us their applications actually because they think it's a good idea to do security testing, right? So these are already people that are probably thinking securely. So it's probably even worse. I didn't talk about control line feed injection. It's something we check for, but it's not that risky an issue. Information leakage. This is where sensitive data is being sent off the device. We found that in 40% of the applications. Time and state, those are race condition type issues, typically pretty hard to exploit, so I didn't talk about that, but we looked at it. 23% had SQL injection issues. A lot of people don't know that a lot of applications use a small little SQL database on their back end to store data. Well, if the data that you're grabbing over the network has SQL injection attack strings in it, someone can compromise the device through that. And so I think we find about 40% of web applications have this problem, which is a huge epidemic problem. We find it 23% of the time in mobile apps. And that's probably just because many more web applications use SQL than mobile. And then we still see some cross-site scripting, authorization issues, and then credential management. That's where you have your hard-coded password. And so 5% of the applications, we see that. And then we have some data on iOS. 81% had error handling issues. This is more of a code quality problem. But 67% had cryptographic issues. So not quite as bad as Android. Maybe the APIs are a little bit easier, the example code's a little better on iOS, but still a very high percentage. We had 54% with information leakage, about 30% with buffer management errors. That's places where there could potentially be a memory corruption issue. It turns out that that's not as much of a problem for exploitation on iOS because iOS, all the code has to be signed, so it's hard for an attacker to execute arbitrary code on iOS. Code quality, directory traversal, but then credentials management here at 14.6%, so worse than on the Android. We have people not handling passwords correctly. And then the numeric errors and buffer overflow, those are more going to be code quality issues on iOS. So that was it for my presentation. I think we're, I don't know if we're out of time or not. I don't know if there's any questions.
Quick question around fragmentation in the Android market. Because one of the issues, Apple at least owns patching. Mm-hmm. They do a good job of getting it out there, whereas less so in the Android space. You almost need to jailbreak your phone to stay current with the current release of Android.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. And so if you think about... Oh, right. So the question was, what about fragmentation of the operating system on the Android platform? How does that affect the riskiness of those devices? And it actually is a huge problem, because what happens is the older devices, when someone comes up with a jailbreak for that device, and so essentially that's privilege escalation. Until that operating system is updated, any malware can then use that vulnerability to totally compromise the device. And what we're seeing on the Android is, in order to get a new operating system, Google has to put out the operating system, and then the hardware manufacturer has to customize it, and then the carrier has to customize it and deliver it. So you have basically three moving parts here, and it's turning out that the carriers don't care, and the hardware manufacturers don't care, and Google's not prodding them enough to do anything. So essentially, over half of the devices out there have operating systems that have these privilege escalation vulnerabilities in them. And so if you get malware in your Android device, it's much more of a problem. Okay, thank you very much.